at my servant who has come in communion with me, while the dissolute people and the negligent are tired. Bear testimony that I forgave him. The blessed month of Ramadan is the best part of the year, and midnight prayer is one of the best springboards of fasting persons. The Prophet of Islam says, midnight prayer is a means for God's satisfaction and friendship of angels. Midnight prayer is a practice and tradition of prophets, the light of cognizance and root of faith. On the day of judgment, midnight prayer will be the shadow over the individual's head, crown on his head, and garment for his body, just as it will be the light ahead of him and the barrier between him and the fire of hell. Injection and serum therapy are among the common questions of fasting persons during the month of Ramadan. Most of the sources of emulation say that injection of nutritious shots and serums that are often used for impairment will nullify fasting, but the shots that are done for benumbing or medicines which are put on wounds do not nullify fasting. Also, hepatitis B vaccine, which is a hypodermic shot, does not nullify fasting. Distilled water, which is usually used in medical faculties for teaching injection to students, will nullify fasting if it is shot in the vessel. But if it is shot in the muscle, it will not nullify fasting. Endoscopy is also recommended to be avoided in Ramadan. Ulema also say that blood injection will nullify fasting. However, suppository does not nullify fasting. Even the special suppositories which are used by women and contain lubricants do not nullify fasting. Ramadan is the month of abstention from the acts that are permissible in other months. But, as it had been said many times, fasting is not restricted to abstention from eating, drinking, and a few other pleasures. According to the Prophet of Islam and his infallible progeny Ahl al-Bayt, during the days of Ramadan, we should try to prevent each of our bodily organs from its related sin. Ramadan is the month of practice and preparation, or greatest struggle, which is called Jihad Akbar, or the greatest jihad. It is the struggle against the soul, which constantly invites to evil. This struggle will lead to turning the soul into a sure soul, that is, soul at peace, as it has been mentioned in the final ayahs of Surah Fajr. This soul is pleased with God, and God is pleased with it. The concluding ayahs of Surah Fajr reads, O soul at peace, return to your Lord, pleased, pleasing. Then enter among my servants and enter my paradise. In the month of Ramadan, God has extended His hand to help us. He forgives our sins with very small excuses. He grants us great rewards for very paltry deeds. Ramadan is the best period for untying the chains and shackles from our hands and feet, the chains that have been tied by our sins and disobedience of God. One of the supplications that have been recommended to recite in Ramadan is the following. O God, Lord of the month of Ramadan, in which you sent down the Quran and obligated in it fasting for your servants, grant us as sustenance the Hajj of your sacred house in this year and every year, and forgive those great sins of mine, Indeed, no one forgives them except you, O owner of glory and nobility.
The subcontinent. Hi everyone, this is your host John, and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region of South Asia as a whole. We'll try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the recent ceasefire agreement between India and Pakistan that has brought back relative peace along the disputed border areas. Then we will explore the reverberations of the New Deal in the domestic and foreign politics of the two countries, as well as its numerous repercussions for the geopolitical future of Asia.
India and Pakistan have recently issued a joint statement to announce that they will strictly observe all of their agreements on ceasefire along the so-called line of control and other disputed areas. This was the first joint statement in nearly 20 years. Historically, whenever ceasefires are announced via different statements, they tend to fail. But a joint statement by both militaries is a proof that the deal is a result of back-channel negotiations and may have a better chance to last. Should it hold, the new agreement may be a big deal for India and Pakistan, and arguably for the whole world.
The recent India-Pakistan ceasefire agreement along the so-called line of control has brought relative calm to border areas, which were the scenes of bloody conflicts for much of the 2020 well into this year. After over a decade of fighting since their last similar deal, the Director Generals of Military Operations of the two nations issued a rare joint statement that put into effect the cessation of hostilities since late February. The generals said from now on they want to address each other's core issues and concerns, and also envisage pullback of specialized forces that are stationed for trans-border offensive maneuvers and operations. Since their Great Partition, Islamabad and New Delhi have been caught in a vicious circle that has been deadly and devastating, and have come up with numerous agreements with limited longevity. But the New Deal is reported to be the result of many rounds of high-level back-channel negotiations away from the public eye, and probably many politicians. Hence, hopes are a little higher. However, their flimsy communication hotline is still in a nascent stage, and only a test of time will tell if it has the potential to create a lasting peace between the two nuclear-armed countries.
Weeks after India and Pakistan agreed on quote-unquote strict observance of the 2003 ceasefire, the pact continues to be followed on the ground with no apparent signs of violation. With the renewal of their commitment to nearly two-decade-old ceasefire along the border, the winds of change are blowing in relations of the two. But are they strong enough to turn the tide in the deep sea of distrust between the two classic adversaries?
India and Pakistan, along with other nations in South Asia, are members of a subcontinental civilizational family tied together by bonds of shared culture, religion, race and language. The fathers of Pakistan and India wanted them to live in peace, not in permanent conflict. Mahatma Gandhi had the audacity to publicly call both India and Pakistan as his country. Although geographically and politically India is divided in two, at heart we shall be friends and brothers, helping and respecting one another, and be one for the outside world, Gandhi famously said on January 26, 1948, just 4 days before his assassination at the hands of a Hindu extremist. Muhammad Ali Jinnah also desired good and neighborly relations, something he described as an association similar to that between the US and Canada. The ceasefire accord heralds a new era of Indo-Pak ties, but only if it can withstand the likely setbacks along the way. There are multitudes of concurring or conflicting forces, both in support and opposition of the new momentum for peace, from inside the two countries, militaries, parliaments or administrations, along with regional and international players with some stake in the game.
If there is a peace, of course, the whole region will enjoy, the whole region will develop, the whole region will welcome. Against this, if there is any confrontation, because India and Pakistan both are the nuclear states and they have the capabilities to destroy each other completely, that will be disaster not only for India and Pakistan but for the whole region. The peace is only hope, and the hope for the Asia, for the whole region. I believe that all other countries in the Asia, they will appreciate and they will like it.
The timing of the newly achieved agreement was the source of a lot of contentious speculations in itself. It happened after months of secret talks, but suspiciously around at the same time India reached a somehow similar deal with China. This has caused many to question Beijing's role during the back-channel meetings. Another touchy subject purportedly linked to the ceasefire is the election of Joe Biden into the White House. Many argue that if Donald Trump had managed to stay in office, such an agreement would never have been clinched.
Given the hype in expectations and the special discourse and circumstances around the ceasefire, the agreement seems more than a strategic maneuver or a solitary move. With the impression that it is only the first step in a longer peace process, the announcement could not have emerged without top-notch diplomatic work by the two governments, and probably with some help from others. The influence of Beijing on the deal, or where China stands in this complex geopolitical equation, has remained unclear, but the timing of the agreement indicates a high correlation, as the Indo-Pak deal was publicized following another Himalayan de-escalation effort in the India-China border areas. In any conceivable scenario, the future of the new treaty will be intertwined with the dynamics of the two countries' relations with China. Another external factor with considerable weight on the ceasefire can be the new US administration. India wants China contained but does not want to do the job itself. When Donald Trump was in office, Premier Narendra Modi was certain of Washington's harsh approach towards Beijing. But with Joe Biden at the helm, India needs new tactics to control the extent of interactions between its two main rivals, Pakistan and China.
Washington is far away from this region, and we do not know how much interest they have in the peace in this region. But of course, they are close ally with India. They are bound in Quad alliance with Japan, Australia, India and America. They are, of course, are very much concerned about India, about Pakistan. We were close ally with the Western world during the Cold War, but since for last couple of decades, Washington was keeping distance from Pakistan and tilting toward India more and more.
Last year was the worst year since the 2003 ceasefire, as the two armies recorded about 5,000 bouts of skirmishes in border areas. But worst year for whom? Many of the killed or injured people are not even from the two countries' militaries. Most of them are the innocent inhabitants of the border villages stuck in a decades-long political conundrum, mainly over Kashmir. Indian and Pakistani authorities have often described the Kashmir issue as their only real problem. But can this new deal solve the issue of Kashmir forever?
Since their independence from British colonial rule in 1947, India and Pakistan have fought many wars, with regular fatal scuffles across the tumultuous borders. Almost all the efforts to bring peace and normalcy have crumbled with no breakthrough, mostly due to their irreconcilable positions on Kashmir. The Indian government abrogated the special constitutional status of Jammu and Kashmir in 2019, making the would-be independent Kashmir a federally controlled territory. For Islamabad, Kashmir is essential to the idea of Pakistan's creation, and any acceptance of the new status quo is bound to be seen as letting down the Kashmir cause. Unless India and Pakistan reach an understanding on the way forward in their Kashmir policies, the people of Kashmir will be the actual sufferers of the new diplomatic feat. Any future for the virtually non-existent bilateral relationship between India and Pakistan is only imaginable if they find a solution for Kashmir. A united Asia is only possible with a balanced triangle of power among China, India and Pakistan, in addition to close cooperation with other powerhouses like Russia and Iran. This is not a reality yet, not until a solution is found for Kashmir.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight and analysis, we are joined by Mr. Ravi Nitesh. He's a social activist and the founder of Aghaz-e-Dosti. Mr. Nitesh, welcome to the show. So, there have been ceasefires throughout the history between India and Pakistan. Do you think this one would beg to differ and last?
Actually, what we see that first of all, this ceasefire pact that happened between the DGMOs of India and Pakistan is definitely a positive step. Whether it is different from the past or not is a separate question, because this is not the first ceasefire pact. Actually, ceasefire goes into the history since 1949, when the ceasefire line was drawn between India and Pakistan, and it followed in 1972 Simla Agreement, when the ceasefire line converted into line of control. And even after that, when in 1999 the Kargil conflict happened between India and Pakistan, then the ceasefire violations goes up to very high level. And even after that, in 2003, there was a ceasefire agreement between the government of India and government of Pakistan. And after the 2003 ceasefire agreement, there is a drastic lowering down of ceasefire violations incidents. If you will see the numbers, you will find that in 2002, there were more than 8,000 ceasefire violations happened in 1 year. While after the agreement happened between government of India and Pakistan at the time of Vajpayee and Musharraf, so at that time, in 2004, it drastically goes to nil. And then again, from the 2003 to 2004, 5, 6, 7, 8, it goes to normal. And after 2012-13, it again started increasing. 2013, there was again a DGMO ceasefire promise that they will follow the ceasefire. 2018, again DGMOs promised each other that they will follow the ceasefire. And now it is 2021. Because this year, if we will see 2020, there were more than 5,100 ceasefire violations. And when it comes to a human cost, it is huge and huge. So what I see, that this is definitely a positive step, but
frankly, I don't see that it is very different from the historical ceasefire agreements that happened in the past, but always denied and violated.
All right, so you think that it's a positive step, but it won't make much difference. So, moving ahead, Indian and Pakistani authorities have often described the issue of Kashmir as their only real problem. Can this new deal solve the issues in Kashmir?
No, I definitely don't think that this new deal can solve the problem. But definitely, if there are ceasefire violations, then it is means very highlighted issue on both the sides. And if the local population will be affected and the local environment will be unstable, then definitely there can be no other talks. So if ceasefire agreement has happened, even if between the DGMOs, which is only means army sides on both the sides, it's army ranks DGMOs, and when DGMO agreed that ceasefire will be observed, then definitely the government's diplomatic and political channels can become active to talk on other issues, including the Kashmir. Because Kashmir is not the only issue on both the sides. There are many other issues, including Kashmir. So it is it can help in creating a positive environment to take other CBMs or to talk on other things. Because when we see that there were many CBMs that were taken already on place between both the countries. There were buses going on from India to Pakistan, Pakistan to India. There were trade, there were postal services, but all are stopped. All are stopped. At present, there is no trade. There is no bus going on. There is no postal services. So what we think as a civil society persons, as a people who support the peace and people-to-people relations, that definitely this ceasefire pact brings a positive impact, a positive hope for everyone, and particularly for the people who are living near the borders and in the Jammu and Kashmir area, towards Indian side as well as towards Pakistan side.
All right, Mr. Nitesh, before moving ahead, our team has collected a few global media coverages in this regard, and I would appreciate if you could just take a look and then we can move forward.
The Director Generals of Military Operations of India and Pakistan held discussions over the established mechanism of hotline contact. The two sides reviewed the situation along the line of control and all other sectors in a free, frank and cordial atmosphere, in the interest of achieving mutually beneficial and sustainable peace along the borders. The two militaries agreed to address each other's core issues and concerns, which have propensity to disturb peace and lead to violence. Both sides reiterated that existing mechanisms of hotline contact and border flag meetings will be utilized to resolve any unforeseen situation or misunderstanding. The 2003 ceasefire came at a time when Pakistan, in the wake of 9/11, was under tremendous pressure from the US to clean up its act. This unwritten ceasefire was preceded by a back-channel process that had begun around 2000. It led to the Musharraf-Vajpayee joint statement, in which Pakistan declared it would not permit any terrorist group to operate in its territory or launch a terrorist attack from its territory on foreign soil. For people living alongside the lock, ceasefire have revived their lives, brought peace and given security after about 10 years of warlike situation prevailing in the border areas. The people in this belt were the main victims of any shelling. Now, the families residing in this area have started social functions and inviting friends and relatives to their houses. The habitats have again got an opportunity of secured life with honor and dignity. It is a fact that ceasefire will provide huge relief to people living in border areas alongside the lock on both sides and open the gates for further steps towards normalcy.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Nitesh. So, If peace can establish between India and Pakistan, will it help create a united Asia?
See, when it comes to united Asia, when if one will see the India and Pakistan, so first of all they see that it lies in South Asia, and one can see that the South Asian Regional Coordination, that is SARC. SARC is almost failed concept, only because India and Pakistan were not agreed to go hand in hand with each other. Since 2016, there is no meeting of SARC, since 2016. And whenever the SARC meets, there are issues arise of India and Pakistan. There are many other countries. Nepal is there, Bhutan is there, Maldives is there, Sri Lanka is there, Bangladesh is there, Afghanistan is there in the SARC. But all other issues come went to back foot when it comes to India and Pakistan conflict. So definitely I think if India and Pakistan can go hand in hand, can compromise on each other, can settle their long unresolved disputes, and can observe the ceasefire, can carry the promise of developing a regional coordination and peace, then definitely it can not only help the India and Pakistan, but also the whole South Asia. And because the South Asia region is connected with all other regions like Central Asia, Middle East, Southeast Asia, and all these the Asia region has a huge potential. If they will just coordinate with each other and just cooperate with each other. You see that when it comes to IPI, Iran Pakistan India pipeline, so you see that this pipeline can definitely serve a big goal, a huge purpose of energy needs in Pakistan as well as in India. But it is not happening. It is not. When it comes to China, we see that China is a big country. China is a very big country. And when it comes to China, Pakistan, India, then Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, so Russia, so all these Asian players can definitely, if they will coordinate with each other and cooperate with each other, I must believe that the Asian continent can reach a greater height.
All right, that marks the end of this question answer session. Thank you so much, Mr. Nitesh, for being with us. Viewers, now people have voiced their opinions on social media and cyberspace, so let's just take a quick look at what they think.
Team Bharat wrote on Twitter, Thread India and Pakistan have provided a sigh of relief to their citizens, especially the ones who live right next to the barbed wires marking the line of control. The ceasefire agreement on Indo-Pak border is a positive initiative wholly welcomed by India. Samir P. Lalwani posted on his Twitter, in the last 3 years alone, 341 civilians had died in the border firing that included small arms and artillery shelling. Tara believes step one is to evolve a clear and relatively transparent, clear border management strategy between the two sides. But that means Pakistan giving up terror seems unlikely.
All right, and that was our episode covering the peace deal between India and Pakistan. Thanks.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Imam Khomeini was a religious scholar and a true worshipper and servant of God. If you remember the previous episode, it was said that Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was very hateful of doing mustahab or recommended acts, although they're not religiously obligatory. You also heard that he was very careful not to do makruh or disapproved acts. The acts that are not haram or forbidden but have been emphasized to refrain from. Today we are going to continue the discussion. Nafile in Arabic means additional. According to the Islamic jurisprudence, it means the daily prayers that are not obligatory and just recommended. These prayers have a lot of reward. There are 34 rak'at of recommended prayers which are performed with daily ritual obligatory ones. But on Friday, 4 rak'at are added to this number. These prayers are highly emphasized to recite as God will give ample rewards for them. However, the midnight prayer is the most important recommended prayer and has a lot of effects in both material and spiritual aspects of human life. According to the statements of the Prophet and the infallible Imams, recommended prayers somehow compensate for the shortcomings of obligatory ones. Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, says in this regard, "Indeed, we have been ordered to perform recommended prayers in order to compensate for the defects of obligatory prayers." Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, also says, "God said, 'Indeed, my servant seeks proximity to me by recommended prayer and deeds, and once I like him, I will be his ear that he hears with it, his eye that sees with it, and his tongue that speaks with it.'" Hujjat al-Islam Rasuli Mahallati said, "As far as I remember and I have heard from the relatives and companions of Imam Khomeini, he would not give up performing recommended prayers as much as he could. Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini didn't give up performing recommended prayers even when the security forces of the Pahlavi regime, Savak, intruded into his house. Late Ayatollah Tavassuli also mentioned an interesting memory. In the evening of the day in which the tragedy of Fayzi school happened, we were at the Imam's home. We heard that the seminary students had been beaten and the regime forces intended to come there. Late Sayyid Muhammad Sadiq stood up and closed the door of the house. But Imam Khomeini immediately stood up and opened the door, saying, "Shall I close the door of my house while they are beating my children?" Then he stood up for prayer and, like other nights, performed midnight prayer, while every moment his house would likely be attacked. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini would not leave performing of recommended prayers even at the times that he was exhausted. Late Ayatollah Bani Fazil related a memory on this. In the first days after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Qom, Imam Khomeini had public meetings from 8:30 a.m. till midday, during which he would deliver detailed speeches, so he had to go upstairs to the roof several times. One day, a few minutes before noon, the Imam's face was very tired as he was going into the room. I said to myself that this time he would have a rest, but when I followed him, I saw him performing recommended prayer of midday obligatory prayer. Imam Khomeini would observe little points even in recommended prayers. For instance, he would not forget saying, "A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim," which means, "I seek refuge with God from the outcast Satan." Imam's companions also say that he used to recite Surah Tawhid in both his obligatory and recommended prayers, although it can be dropped in recommended ones. Imam Khomeini would not give up performing of recommended prayers even in hot summer. Ayatollah Qadiri says, "In the blessed month of Ramadan, when the Imam would come to the school of late Ayatollah Borujerdi in Najaf for midday and afternoon prayers, he used to first perform the 8 rak'at recommended prayers of midday prayer and then perform the midday prayer itself. This was not an easy job for a fasting person of that age and in such a hot weather. Even the youth would fail to do it, but the Imam was so serious in worships." Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Mujtaba Rudbari relates the memory. "In such an old age and during the hot days of Ramadan in Najaf, Imam Khomeini would observe the recommended prayers of Maghrib or Dusk and Isha, that is 9 obligatory prayers, whereas we as young people were expecting to finish prayer to go to iftar for breaking the fast."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khomeini's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
40 recommendations by Imam Khamenei for the journey towards God. Internal obstacles. The path ahead is clear for us, and the obstacles are also clear for the Iranian nation. You must overcome these obstacles, both the internal obstacles and the external ones. The internal obstacles can be overcome by supplication to God, prayer, attention to God, self-edification, and reinforcing morals. If our hearts are not purified, we will not be able to build a correct world. If we are defective inside, we cannot fix a defective society and a defective world. The Iranian nation has a great responsibility that has to be fulfilled. They have to build a wonderful world both for themselves and for other societies. You can do it, but only if each and every one of us works on self-edification. Praying attentively, reciting Quran, prayer and supplication, fasting in Ramadan, and night prayers, especially for the youth who are more receptive, can be self-edifying.
رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان 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 يا حبيب رمضان ليتك دوما قريب
One hour in seclusion. Pray. Stand up the night in prayers. Contemplate. Be attentive by dhikr. Spend an hour between yourself and God. Put different occupations aside and get closer to God, God's friend, and Imam al-Mahdi, God hasten his reappearance. Get closer to Quran and reflect on it. Mosque as a base. Establish brotherly ties with the Imam of your mosque, the worshippers at the mosque, and the believers who visit the mosque, and safeguard and fortify those ties. Stand up in prayer at the earliest time, in congregation, in any mosque you find yourself in. Attend religious gatherings at mosques. Attend Quran and dua recitation sessions. Make mosques more attractive.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In the limelight.
Austin's personal history and connection to the military and rating mark him as a fitting Pentagon chief in an era of destructive militarism and creeping fascism in the U.S., says Jeremy Kuzmarov, writer, in an article titled, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has awarded over $2.36 billion in contracts to Raytheon since his confirmation in January. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. March 23rd was another good day for Raytheon, with a receipt of $63,301,453 contract for repair of an APG G573 all-weather sensor radar system, which is operational in the U.S. Navy's F-18 fighter jets, and another $10,246,288 contract for repair of military jet engines. The company had yet more cause for celebration on March 30th. When Raytheon's Tucson, Arizona branch received a $130 million contract for upgrades to the Rolling Airframe Missile Block 2 to a guided missile round pack, which is designed to protect U.S. Navy ships from incoming missiles. The next day, two separate contracts amounting to $138 million, one for more F-35 maintenance work and another for the production of mine-hunting sonars. Though Austin claims to have recused himself from decisions involving Raytheon, the Pentagon under his direction is providing his old company with huge contracts on a daily basis that is bolstering its profits and stock price. Austin furthermore has used his new bully pulpit to advance for yet greater levels of military spending to the benefit of Raytheon. On February 25th, for example, on a visit to the USS Nimitz, Austin emphasized the need for U.S. warship throughout the globe to deter security threats. A week later, on a tour of Southeast Asia with Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Austin warned about China again and North Korean nuclear threat and pledged that the U.S. would maintain a robust military presence in the Indo-Pacific. He further cautioned North Korea that the U.S., following military exercises with South Korea, was ready to fight tonight. When fighting resumed in eastern Ukraine in early April, Austin assured Ukraine's defense minister, Andriy Taran, of the U.S. commitment to building the capacity of Ukraine's forces to defend more effectively against Russia. which was demonstrated by a recent $125 million military aid package, and took to Twitter to reaffirm the U.S. unwavering support for Ukraine's sovereignty, territorial integrity, and Euro-Atlantic aspirations. The latter implied the joining of the European Union and North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, which would inevitably escalate conflict between the world's two major nuclear armed powers, the U.S. and Russia. On April 13th, Austin announced that the U.S. would increase its military presence in Germany by about 500 personnel and was scuttling plans to introduce by President Donald Trump for a large troop reduction in Europe. Austin, meanwhile, in Tel Aviv, affirmed the U.S.-Israeli regime relationship, which receives a record $3.8 billion in U.S. military aid each year, and on a visit to Afghanistan, stated that the Biden administration wanted to see a responsible end to the Afghan war, but that the level of violence must decrease for fruitful diplomacy to have a chance. These comments and many others were music to the ears of Raytheon, which gave $506,424 in donations to Biden's presidential campaign. Besides his connection to Raytheon, Austin's appointment as Pentagon chief was controversial because he had not been retired from the military for the requisite 7 years and required a legal waiver. Traditionally, the role of defense secretary is supposed to be a civilian position, ensuring the U.S. military apparatus is led not by a war fighter, but a policymaker. That requirement is laid out in the National Security Act of 1947 that established the Defense Department. Heralded as a soldier who would endure hardships with his troops, Austin graduated from West Point in 1975 and led infantry troops in the capture of Baghdad during the 2003 Operation Iraqi Freedom. After a stint commanding the 10th Mountain Division in Afghanistan, Austin was appointed as Chief of Staff of U.S. Central Command at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida, a high-tech command post where military officers could watch live imagery on plasma screens and order airstrikes through the Pentagon's secure internet server. Groomed for high military command by Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 2007 to 2011, Austin was appointed as Commanding General of U.S. Forces in Iraq in 2010 and Commander of U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, which is responsible for military operations in the West Asia North Africa region by President Obama in 2013. In this latter capacity, Austin drafted a war plan approved by Obama that allowed the U.S. military for the first time to directly provide ammunition and weapons to Syrian opposition forces, who included terrorists. President Obama also endorsed General Austin's idea to increase the air campaign on Daesh from Incirlik Air Base in Turkey. The result was an increase in civilian deaths. Journalists Anand Gopal and Azmat Khat determined that 1 in 5 of 27,500 coalition airstrikes in the second Iraq war resulted in at least one civilian death, more than 31 times the number that was publicly acknowledged. Austin's personal history and connection to the military and Raytheon mark him as a fitting Pentagon chief in an era of destructive militarism and creeping fascism in the U.S., when civilians no longer control the key institutions of government and war industries ensure the perpetuation of endless wars from which they make obscene profits, the political system can no longer be defined as a democracy. We'll be right back.
around the world with reporters.
The Palestinian Authority, along with different political factions, held Israel fully responsible for the serious deterioration in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds over the past few days and called on the international community to put pressure on the Israeli regime to stop its provocations. Israeli police and settler violence erupted in the area on Thursday night and continued through Friday, leaving over 100 Palestinians wounded and scores more arrested.
Since the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, Israeli forces had been escalating measures against the people there, starting by cutting off loudspeakers of Al-Aqsa Mosque. That's why our people in Al-Quds are protesting and rising against oppression and crimes by the Israeli regime.
But the issue is not only between the Israeli police and the Palestinians. Since the start of the holy month of Ramadan, every night hundreds of Israeli settlers rush to the streets of the holy city and assault Palestinians under the protection of the Israeli forces. The extremist settlers chant death to Arabs during their marches. Hundreds of ultra-nationalist Israelis marched through central Jerusalem towards the Damascus Gate, which police had barricaded as a precaution.
Verbal condemnation of Israel over the aggression is not enough. The Palestinian factions must offer all forms of support to Al-Quds and its residents. Palestinians must stand united behind Al-Quds. What's going on is an uprising, and here in occupied West Bank, protests and demonstrations should continue. This is the least we can do to defend Al-Quds.
Palestinians say Israeli police want to prevent them from saying their prayers and the usual Ramadan evening gatherings at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and outside the Damascus Gate.
Protests which flared up in Jerusalem Al-Quds have now spilled over to the occupied West Bank in defense of the Holy City and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinians warned that Tel Aviv is heading towards a heavy-handed crackdown against them in the occupied territories to ward off another surge in Palestinians' protests and anger. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Nowadays, Afghan security and military forces are witnessing the last months of the presence of their US-led NATO allies. These forces are determined to protect their country against any threats on their own without any outside help. As top military officials here say, the Afghan armed forces will overcome any challenges after the pullout of foreign troops by drawing on the experience they have gained in fighting terrorism over the past two decades.
Currently, US-led NATO forces are stationed in their bases only in Bagram and Balkh provinces, but they will leave these key bases too. We won't be worried about this because our forces have, over the past two decades, gained enough experience on how to counter terrorists.
Confirming that Afghan military and security forces are still in need of financial support, the Afghan government says the good news is that foreign forces will hand over military hardware to the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces when they leave the country by September 11.
Based on our negotiations with foreign military officials, they will hand over weapons and other military equipment worth $1 billion to Afghan National Defense and Security Forces when they leave the country.
According to experts here, because the Afghan National Armed Forces are popular among locals, Afghan people are expected to stand by these troops and support any possible scenario that might unfold after the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan. Still, they